Hillary Clinton today accepting full responsibility for the election loss, except for the part when she blamed Comey, Putin, WikiLeaks, misogyny, and the media.
If you are saying he can't do his job because of his race, is that not the definition of racism?
No, I don't think so at all.
There are a few broadcast journalists as fearless, dogged, and engaged as CNN's Jake Tapper, whose show The Lead airs every weekday at 4 p.m. The 49-year-old Philadelphia native arrived at CNN after a stint at ABC News, but his journalistic sensibility was shaped in the late 90s and early aughts, when he wrote for alternative media outlets such as Salon, the Washington City Paper, and the pioneering satire site Suck.com. Tapper has just released his first novel, The Hellfire Club, which is set in 1950s D.C. It features cameos by historical figures such as Jack Kennedy and Joseph McCarthy, and involves all sorts of sexual intrigue and political corruption. Tapper sat down with Reason to talk about the new book and why his alternative media roots give him a leg up on journalists who came up through the traditional mainstream media.
Jake Tapper, thanks for talking to Reason.
It's great to see you again, Nick.
Well, let's talk about the Hellfire Club, which chronicles the adventures of an accidental and fictional congressman named Charlie Martyr in the mid-50s as he stumbles across a conspiracy involving massive corruption of politicians, lobbyists, military contractors, and military figures. What led you to write a novel and this novel in the first place?
I thought it would be fun. I thought it would be challenging. There were a lot of thoughts I had about Washington, D.C., having lived here now and covered it for a couple decades, that I wanted to kind of express in a way that that was more emotional than fact-based, meaning in a fictional way. Charlie Martyr and his wife come to Washington, as you say, and one of the things that the book tries to depict, in addition to this conspiracy that they stumble into, is the compromises that people in Washington are forced to make, and the fact that good people come here to this town wanting to do good, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and little by little they make compromises. Sometimes they're small, like I won't criticize anybody in my party kind of thing.
Right.
But sometimes they're bigger, and next thing you know, they're drowning in the swamp. Mm-hmm. President Trump's not wrong about the swamp, as you know. The swamp's real. Swamp's, you know, I don't know that he's fixing it, but the swamp's a problem.
So, I mean, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book, which is a really good page turner, and particularly early on, it's rich in these kinds of historical details before the plot kind of takes over, because it is a mystery, et cetera. And it's fun. I highly recommend anybody reading it. Buying it and reading it, but it's rich in these kind of historical details, ironies, nuances. So, for instance, Bobby and Jack Kennedy have a cameo kind of early on, but then, and you mention him, Joe McCarthy is a big figure in the book, and Roy Cohn, his odious aide. But you point out that Bobby Kennedy is kind of like a good guy, but that he was there because he's working for McCarthy, and McCarthy's even the godfather of one of his kids. Why is it useful to remind people that there are only feet of clay among politicians?
I just thought that that the fact that the Kennedys and McCarthy were actually close in real life was an important part of the story, and also an important part of what I was trying to capture in terms of the Washington swamp and the alliances that exist. The Kennedys and McCarthy were buddies, maybe because it was the 50s and they were all Irish and it was kind of tribal, as one member of the Kennedy family explained to me one time when I asked why. But, you know, Ambassador Kennedy, who's also kind of looming in the background in the book.
That's Joseph Sr.
The father of Jack and Robert Kennedy. He convinced McCarthy not to campaign against John F. Kennedy for Senate in 1952. That's a fact.
Right.
I mean, I put in this conspiracy and secret society to try to explain it in some ways, but that's true.
Do you think that Washington, I mean, you, and the book is reminiscent of books like Alan Drury's Advise and Consent, and there used to be this genre of a kind of DC novel, which was about how politics is always soul-killing and compromise-inducing. But, you know, that genre seems to have kind of faded. Is that because politics really isn't as bad as it used to be?
Well, that's a really tough question. Well, first of all, I should point out that there are good guys in the book, and the good guys, a lot of them are politicians, too. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though I don't think any politician can do good. But that said, I think that it is somewhat less swampy today in Washington because of A, the post-Watergate reforms, and there's more transparency, there's more aggressive journalism, there are more journalistic outlets out there challenging.
Yeah, one of the amazing things about the book is that you know, and the title gives away a secret society called the Hellfire Club, which is based on kind of 17th century or 17th, 18th century sex clubs and kind of businessmen clubs in England and elsewhere, and you point that out in pretty good detail. The press was in the club, right? I mean, and certainly through the 60s, and you could argue later, but not in the way that they used to be, where the press was, it's not just they were covering for politicians, they were right there next to them at the whorehouse, basically.
Totally, 100%. I mean, look, we know that the press corps covered up for instance, John F. Kennedy and his infidelities. That, I mean, that's just a fact. And so I think that inevitably we're better off today. Mm-hmm. One of the kind of like throwaway scenes in the book is Joseph Alsop was a famous columnist, a real one. Mm-hmm. He wrote three or four times a week with his brother. And in the book, it comes out that Alsop did work for the CIA while also being a columnist. That's true. That's based on, Carl Bernstein wrote a story about it, I think, for Rolling Stone. There's a whole endnote section at the end of the book about, so people can find out what's true and what's not true. But he really did that. I mean, that just boggles the mind.
Would you do something like
that? No, never.
Would you admit that you were doing it if you were doing it?
Well, I wouldn't do it, but now you've caught me. No matter what, I'm saying no.
Well, no, but I mean, because that type of shift is pretty amazing, right? That journalists... I mean, it's interesting that in various institutions across American life where confidence is leaking out, politicians, media, you know, various other places, the police, they're actually more professionalized than they've ever been. I mean, I think journalists have many more ethics now than they did in the 50s or 60s.
Yeah, I think that things are, I think that things are better, without question. I will say the one differential is there's a lot more money in the swamp now than I think there was in the 50s.
Now, is that because, and this is the libertarian me coming out, is that because the government controls so much more of our lives? And they, you know, the book in many ways is a critique and a pretty resounding one of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
But it's everything. Everybody can come here. I mean, we're in the Hunger Games, right? This is the Capital District, and it's pulling in money from all over the country.
Right. Eisenhower is a character in the book, and he says things about the military-industrial complex in a scene that takes place in 1954, that a lot of which I just took from his farewell address in 1961. And the idea that soon we'll be, Eisenhower talks about his fear that soon we will be waging wars based on what these companies want us to do and not what's based on what's best for the American people, which is, of course, something that you guys write about all the time.
Well, and it's a kind of amazing that Eisenhower, who's like, you know, one of the great generals and one of the great thinkers and also increasingly understood to be a very good president.
Great president, yeah.
You know, we didn't really have a standing army before World War II. And 20 years later, he's worrying about a standing army and a perpetual warfare state.
Yeah, I mean, the Pentagon didn't exist until... in the middle of World War II, it opened, and the U.S. Air Force was just part of the Army. Mm-hmm. I mean, the military expanded significantly, and more concerning than that, because obviously we do need to have a military protecting U.S. interests, is the fact that there's so much money, billions, trillions of dollars, and that is in the fear of President Eisenhower going to affect foreign policy so that these companies can sell things and make a lot of money. And I think that his warning has been borne out. And a great deal of the book, the premise of it, has to do with this company, General Kinetics, and the power it is wielding behind the scenes. So, you know, it's a fun thriller, but it is based on a premise that is all too real.
Here, you know, I mean, the book is casually rich in history, which I appreciate a lot. And some of it is that you seem to be, in a lot of your work, you seem to be able to look backward to, say, the World War II era or even before. But, you know, you're interested in drawing connections from the past to the present. None of the stuff we're going through is particularly new. It might have some novel twist to it. Why isn't that attitude more, more widespread in the media?
I think because it takes a certain confidence in making the analysis, because it is an analysis, and some would even call it an opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was researching this book, you know the old saying, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. I don't know who said it.
Right.
Quote investigator doesn't
know
who
said it. You know, I actually came
you
up with
it.
That's mine. Yeah.
I would love to attribute it to you, but you can't read about the 50s and not hear a lot of rhyming today, whether it's about the swamp, whether it's about, you know, whether if you're suspicious of the deep state, you know, take a look at J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
Forget James Comey. And then also just Donald Trump. McCarthyism and Trumpism are very different. They stand for very different things. But the technique of the big lie, smearing and telling lies, you know, McCarthy was doing that. And at the time, the media and Democrats and Republicans were all paralyzed. Not all, but most of them were paralyzed. They didn't know how to deal with this. Oh, my God, am I biased if I call him a liar?
Right.
Oh, my God, is he going to attack me if I call him a liar? And yet we see the same mistakes being made today.
And you saw that in spectacular relief during the Republican primary debates.
Yeah.
Trump, you know, I mean, he was surrounded by, you know, the best that the Republican Party had to offer, an incredibly deep bench, and he was able to just dispense with them one after another by, you know,
flicking them away.
I mean, part of you, I think part of any observer has to be like, God, that guy's fucking great at that. But is it also disturbing? Is it that politicians get what they want? You know, Jeb Bush started to cry when Donald Trump made fun of his mother. I mean, he looked like he was about to cry. Maybe he doesn't deserve to be on that stage.
Well, I will tell you this. So I moderated the second Republican debate in Simi Valley at the Ronald Reagan Library. And the very first question, there were 11 people on stage, very first question, Carly Fiorina, I said, Governor Jindal said he wouldn't feel comfortable with Donald Trump's hand on the nuclear codes. How would you feel? Trump at this point, it was September, he was number one, he'd been number one, he was center stage, sucking out all the oxygen of the room. And anyway, so I asked that of Fiorina, thinking, you know, you muscled your way on stage, Carly, let's do it. And she whiffed it. She just said, you know, that's up for the voters. I went to Trump. He started railing about Rand Paul's inclusion on the stage.
Right.
So then I go to, completely irrelevant, I go to Jeb Bush, same question.
Yeah.
He also whiffs it.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, this guy's going to get the nomination, Donald Trump, because they don't get it. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that you can't wait for someone else to take him out. You have to explain why Bobby Jindal from the undercard debate is right if you want to take him out. And they wouldn't do it. And it was, you know, none of them would go after him until it was too late. And by that time, whether it was Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, they just looked desperate.
Yeah. Do you think Hillary Clinton went after him in the right way? Obviously, in the end, it's a weird election because she did win the popular vote, but she lost the electoral vote. And I think most people, whatever you want to believe about Russia, I mean, she ran a terrible campaign to lose to this guy. But did she not attack him in the right way, kind of front and center and go after him? Or what was her problem?
I was very surprised that their attack on him was all about the indecency and the Access Hollywood tape and the sexism. Not that I don't think that's a decent attack. Yeah. It's a good attack. But then there was a whole other line of attack that I was surprised they kind of just like let lie, which was I feel that they strategically decided we're not going to get these white working class voters, so let's not even waste our time with it. Hence, they didn't go to rural Pennsylvania as much as they should have, Michigan, Wisconsin, et cetera.
Yeah, she went to Chipotle more than she went to Wisconsin, right, during 2016.
Well, I guess that's factual.
I mean, because we know she went
to
Chipotle.
We know we went to Chipotle.
Once.
We have the camera footage, which I know you oppose on a theoretical level.
You know, if it's a private business.
Oh, you got it.
I guess so. I don't know.
But, somebody showed, after Hillary Clinton lost, somebody showed an image from the 2012 campaign of Mitt Romney. It was from an attack ad against Mitt Romney that ran in Michigan. And it was Mitt Romney with a Trump plane behind him. And it was an attack on Mitt Romney. He's a phony. He's going to steal your jobs. He's a robber baron, blah, blah, blah. That whole attack. I don't think that they did enough attacks like that against Donald Trump about the fact that at least two of the three buildings were being, Trump buildings were being constructed with imported Chinese steel, that he has a long history of stiffing working class voters, working class workers for his projects. I mean, whatever you think of Mitt Romney, right? He paid his bills. I mean, he might not have been a member of the working class, but I don't think he was I think that Donald Trump would have been a much easier person to attack on the working class issues than Mitt Romney, because there was a you know, you could have just interviewed a guy literally wearing a hard hat helmet saying, like, you know, I put this drywall in for Donald Trump and he stiffed me. He doesn't care about the working class. But they didn't do any of that, that I saw, at least. They just did the Donald Trump says this about women, Donald, which is, again, a perfectly effective attack for the women in the suburbs of Philadelphia. But I don't know about the working class people in the middle of the state.
Let's talk about politicians a little bit more. Politicians or the political class. As well as things, institutions like the presidency and the White House, independent of who's in them now. Again, massive declines in trust and confidence.
Yeah.
What is at the root of that? Why are people, do you think, why are people so disgusted by Washington politics? And then what can politicians do to change that?
Well, I think, first of all, people are losing confidence in everything.
Right.
Right? I mean, they're losing confidence in the media, in politicians, in all sorts.
So in Volkswagen, in Tesla.
The people don't trust anything. And I think one of the reasons is there's just so much more information, and a lot of that information is negative in terms of media, in terms of other information. What can politicians do to...
To regain the trust and confidence of America?
I think they can stop talking like politicians. It just drives me crazy. I just don't understand it. Why not just talk like a real person? Why, you know?
Well, do they know? But this is like saying, you know, you get money and you can make your own Hollywood movie, and you say, you know what? I'm not going to do all those cliches. I'm not going to do this or that. But then you end up making the same movie over and over again. Is there? I mean, do politicians talk like that because maybe you and I in the media want them to be real, but people really don't?
That might be right. I mean, ultimately, maybe. What you and I are yearning for doesn't play and actually would hurt them. I mean, there is an argument to make that transparency, while important, actually hurts the person being transparent. I know, for instance, like every time I give a speech for money, I give all the money to charity and I disclose it on my Tumblr account and I tweet about it and give a link and say, I just talked to this group. This is what I talked about. This is who they are. This is where all the money is going for, blah, blah, blah. And I know that there are people who say, why are you even doing that? Mm-hmm. All you're doing is exposing yourself to criticism. Nobody else in media does that. And so many people give speeches for money. And that is, it's probably true that it would be better for, I mean, I'm subjecting myself to more criticism that way.
Justin Amash, the libertarian-leaning Republican congressman from Michigan, he lists and explains every vote that he takes on his Facebook page. Is that a good model for politicians?
It's great, but it's probably more downside than upside, right? I mean, that's just the bottom line, is that when it comes to this transparency business, and I know this is somebody who tries to be kind of transparent, mm-hmm. as transparent as I can be without boring people to death, there's probably more downside than upside. When Senator Roy Blunt came on my show, my Sunday show, and I asked him basically, doesn't it bother you that Donald Trump lies so much? He didn't reject the premise of the question. He said it would probably bother me more, you know, if we weren't getting so much accomplished. So he kind of admitted it, but by the same token, he also wouldn't like give a bite in which he said, like, well, I wish he wouldn't lie so much.
Yeah.
You know, it'd probably be better for himself if he told the truth.
Who are the politicians that you like talking, or not that you like talking to, but you think are paragons of transparency or trust or just realness?
Wow, that's such a tough question. I mean,
name names.
They all of them to a degree show a little leg. Of the ones I'm talking about, first of all, there are the ones that like never admit anything.
Yeah,
like you have Leader Pelosi on, and you say this congressman just told an obscene and offensive joke about Kellyanne Conway. What's your response? And Nancy Pelosi's like, I don't know anything about.
And what
that.
About Cocaine Mitch? Does he? He's not.
He's so busy doing bumps that like you can't even get him to do an interview. Mitch McConnell's eight balls aside, Rand Paul is somewhat open, somewhat candid, so is Cory Booker, so is Elizabeth Warren. So, I mean, all of them show a little egg. They talk a little bit about, honest answers, but to a degree, they all kind of stick to their talking points and avoid criticizing their own party.
So recently I was listening to an interview you did with Kellyanne Conway, who is an interesting character and is kind of a professional liar. I mean, forget Sarah Sanders. Like, she will, you know, and she's great at it. I mean, I really kind of admire it. She's like...
I don't think you admire her.
She's like, no, I do. I mean, in terms of her performance, it's like artificial intelligence. Like, I don't think nobody... You know, in science fiction movies, you can always get a computer to explode if you get it to contradict itself. She's never going to explode, right? What is it like dealing with people who you know are just going to bullshit you when you have them on your show?
Now, I would say that what she did on Sunday was less lying and more deflecting. Mm-hmm. I would argue that. As opposed to...
And already I'm saying they win because you've already created this incredible glossary of terms. Like, well, that's not a lie. It's a deflection.
Yeah.
And it's not a deflection. You know, it's a riposte or, you know, it's Krav Maga or something. You know, it's like...
The Israeli martial art. So, I agree with you. Look, I mean, to a large extent, any time that you are now talking about how they dealt with your questions about a serious issue dealing with the president, they've won. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, if Stephen Miller comes on my show, he came on my show and started attacking me. And then if an interviewer asks me how I feel about that and what I was going through my head, like, I'm now not talking about President Trump tweeting that he's a very stable genius or whatever. Or with Kellyanne Conway, I was pressing her on a few things. One of them was the president tells lots of lies. And her basic argument was, she, again, didn't disagree with the premise, but basically said, but you don't cover all the times he tells the truth. You know, that was basically, which is, by the way, I wrote
her
an entire
kids,
article.
I feel so bad for her kids. I mean, like, she is, you know, just great.
I wrote an entire piece for McSweeney's in the middle of this crazy last year that was basically, how come we're not talking about all the presidents that John Wilkes Booth didn't kill?
Right.
Which is the counter argument to all of this. And then, you know, I said, well, you know, the president goes on Twitter and says, there are three hostages in North Korea, and President Obama couldn't get them out, but we're going to get them out. Stay tuned, whatever, something like that. And I said, Kellyanne, two of those hostages were taken during the Trump presidency. She said, well, you're focused on the tweet. We're focused on getting out the hostages. Yeah. So, I mean, again...
Does this help explain long-term declines in cable news viewing?
No.
Because, I mean, I know, I fucking do this for a living, and I can't stand... listening to that kind of talk because I got better things to do.
Actually, cable news viewing is up from like 2 years ago.
Right. So, but that's why I said the long-term decline.
I think the long-term decline is because it's not just cable news viewing. Yeah. It's a long-term decline in everything because there are 7,000 channels. I mean, the networks.
Would be remiss if I didn't mention that Reason TV is one of them.
And it's fantastic.
Yeah. It just keeps getting better and better.
And I appreciate that there are no ads because that would be such a sellout. So the network news divisions, right? They have seen, I think, the most precipitous drop-off in viewership. They're still strong and everything like that. But because there are so many channels. And now, if you are a political junkie, you don't have to wait till 6:30 to get the news. You can turn on CNN or any of our competitors.
But now you see you've deflected the question.
No, I'm not deflecting. I'm acknowledging the question like as a larger trend. But I'm saying everyone is facing this because there are so many channels.
One of the reasons that I admire your work is that you're very forthright about this kind of stuff. And but what can other media people do, or what can your colleagues at CNN, as well as at MSNBC and Fox News, what can they do to squeeze more reality out of the people that they're bringing on or the way that they present the news?
Well, I mean, I'm not here to give advice to other people, but I'll just say, like, I think that when you are in that chair or standing there with a microphone, you are not there for yourself. You're there for the people at home, and you should be asking the questions and conducting yourself in a way, trying to think about, like, what they would want you to do. Well, you didn't really answer that question, or, you know, isn't it true that something, you know, that we're there to challenge that, and at a time when there is just this waterfall cascading over us of bullshit, it's important for us to, like, you know, put up an umbrella, try to provide a safe space for viewers to know we're trying to not have any bullshit here, and when it comes on the show, we will call it out, In a respectful way. And that's the most we can do.
Well, and in the wake of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you emerge as a critic of the way that White House Correspondents' Dinner is done, or, you know, in the most recent comedy presentation by Michelle Wolff. You talk a lot about civility. What is civility, and is it just another weasel word for not asking the tough questions?
No, it's not. Yeah. I think tough questions are very important. I've thought that for my whole career, and maybe there are times that I could, there are always times I could look back and think, I could have done that better, mm-hmm. I could have done that better. But I mean, I think if anything, I was known for challenging the Obama administration, and now I'm known for the same thing with Trump. I have not actually been critical of Michelle Wolff.
I mean, she's a comedian. She showed up and did exactly.
She did what people
what
hired.
She was asked.
Yeah.
To
now,
do.
I could quibble with a joke or two and this and that. But my main point is, if we're going to have a conversation about decency and people being respectful of one another, which is not to say we shouldn't disagree with them or call out when they're lying, but not insulting each other in a puerile or mean way. Mm. If we're going to have that conversation. And the Trump people now all of a sudden want to have this conversation because of Michelle Wolff. Great, we've got a backlog. And it starts with President Trump suggesting that Mexicans are rapists. And like, and then it continues to him saying that John McCain...
He did say that some of them he guesses are good people. So, you know, he's a very nuanced thinker.
That's nice.
Right?
That's a great analysis of 12 million people. or saying that John McCain isn't a war hero because he was captured. Right. Or saying, you know, and on and on. Yeah. Making fun of a reporter who has a disability, et cetera. Right. Like... let's have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And no, I don't think it means don't ask tough questions or that reporters and politicians shouldn't go at it. I just mean you don't say, politician number A, you're fat and ugly. And then the politician writes back, well, you're a weasel and you're a loser. That's not what I'm talking about. That's uncivil. But to say, aren't you not telling the truth? Aren't you lying to the American people about X? No. I am telling the truth. Here's why. And that question is biased. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that.
Do you think that the media, the way that it treats its own, and, you know, in the wake of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, there were a number of high-profile people like, you know, Mika Brzezinski, say, or Andrea Mitchell, other people who were like, oh, you know what, Michelle Wolff was terrible, and, this was an attack on civility and on the press. That's kind of bad. And then the way that the press polices its own, I mean, people like Joy Reid or Brian Williams, and I guess they're both at NBC or MSNBC, but like they get off easy, it seems, when they've committed real crimes against accurate reporting. Is that part of the crisis in confidence in the media?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it doesn't really do me any good to criticize competitors.
Right.
Because then people just think I'm taking a shot at a competitor. MSNBC is a competitor. But I will say this. If we don't hold ourselves to a standard of truth-telling, of owning up to mistakes, then we lose credibility. And every time it happens.
Even with Kevin Williamson, the conservative writer from National Review, who was hired, wrote one article for The Atlantic, and they said they wanted more ideological diversity, and then they canned him. And it's not, you know, it's their right to do whatever they want. Any of these companies can kind of do whatever they want. But it does seem to eat away at this pretense that we're a legitimate media. We're not in the tank for one or the other group. But then we're always going to protect our own and get rid of people we disagree with.
Yeah. I mean, that's not how I view my job.
Right.
We have, you know, David Urban, who is a Trump supporter. Mm-hmm. He ran the Trump campaign in our beloved Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Comes on my show quite a bit. I find him to be an artful defender of President Trump, while at the same time, he's not going to pretend it's okay to make fun of people with disabilities.
Right.
And it's important.
Or he's not going to deny that Trump did it in the first
exactly.
place.
Exactly. Which is even worse. So I think it's important to do that. And it's one of the reasons why whenever journalism students ask me what they should be doing, and I say, if you're on social media, you should be following a ton of people that you don't necessarily agree with, just to get their perspectives. I always mention you. I always mention Reason. I always mention Jonah Goldberg and people on the right. I always mention Josh Marshall and people on the left. I think it's important to have as diverse a feed as possible. I'm not even mentioning women, which is a problem. So I guess women on the left and right as well.
Yeah.
And getting as many people of color, people from different countries, et cetera, having as much ideological diversity as possible so that you're getting those inputs and having that influence how you cover stories and having people like that on your panels.
You, I mean, at CNN, you see yourself, you know, and it's a epithet now, but you're part of the mainstream media. It's different than perspective journalism or point of view journalism, like Reason. You know, we're a libertarian magazine. The Nation is.
But even at Reason, you guys disagree. I mean,
And we have a code of honesty, and we always try to show, you know, not always successfully, but we try to show our math so that people can check.
Yeah.
You know, they know our premises, but here's our math, and does it add up? So people can evaluate it. But you see yourself as in a different space in the media landscape, and how does that affect kind of questions of fairness and objectivity? Because sometimes people conflate these, but you seem to have a different understanding. You can be fair, but that doesn't mean you're going to be objective.
Well, objectivity is such a... objectivity is a goal. It's not... Mm-hmm. You can never arrive at objectivity. You're never... It's an aspiration. Mm-hmm. We all have our biases. Some of them we own. I love the Philadelphia Eagles. Mm-hmm. And I think the United States in general is a force for good. Not always, but it aspires to be. Those are biases that are built into...
I don't know which one is more objectionable, but we'll let that pass.
So it's a goal. And knowing that I am, you know, I have the biases that I have from... My dad's a pediatrician. Hmm. My mom's a nurse. That means I look at the medical debates inevitably from their points of view. I was raised as the kid of a doctor, mm-hmm. and a nurse. Knowing that you have those biases is I think important in going into work as a journalist. One of the things, because I started in journalism full-time at Washington City Paper and then at Salon.com, which was very different then than it is now, one of the things I try to imbue in my coverage is that I'm willing to listen to perspectives that I think a lot of mainstream media at least used to kind of just shunt aside. The idea, for instance, that I think it is conventional wisdom in the United States that no matter what, the US military can solve the problem, just send them and they'll solve the problem. And of course, not a lot of thought to what comes after the problem is solved or even if they can solve the problem. But I do think there is a conventional wisdom. I don't think President Trump, if in fact he is ultimately ever going to really challenge that, and I haven't seen any evidence that he actually is going to. He's talked about it, but ultimately he's still kind of doing the conventional wisdom when it comes to sending men and women abroad. I think that's a good thing to shake up that thinking. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the trade deal, same thing with immigration, everything.
So do you have a politics?
Probably. I definitely, even if I were not a journalist, even if I were a screenwriter or a novelist or whatever full time, I would not be a member of a party. Mm-hmm. I'm not now, and I haven't been for years, and there isn't a party.
What party did you belong to?
I was a Democrat a long time ago.
Do you vote?
Not for offices that I cover, but yes.
Oh,
so
really?
Like I cover, okay. I'll vote for mayor, mm-hmm. I'll vote for city council, but I don't vote for president.
Yeah.
The job is much easier given that we're completely disenfranchised in Washington, D.C. So. We don't have senators or representatives, mm-hmm. truly. So, but I don't feel at home in a party. Do I have a politics? I mean, I do think that a certain degree of compassion is important, but I don't know that big government is always... That's another, mm-hmm. I think, conventional wisdom kind of way of looking at problems in Washington, whether it's Bush or Obama or, frankly, Trump, which is more government, better. Mm-hmm. And here we have a problem, more government. Instead of taking the government we have now and reorganizing it, changing it so as to focus on the new problems of 2018. I see that too. That's, I think, something that I've learned from reading a lot of Reason and just like having that challenge in my head.
Well, let's go back to the alternative media roots that you have, because this is fascinating. I mean, Washington City Paper, Salon in the 90s, where you were at. In early 2000.
And Suck.com.
Suck.com, the pioneering satire site that we both wrote for, although we didn't know each other
no.
at the time.
What was your name? What was your name?
I was Mr. Mixelpiddle.
Oh, you're Mr. Mixelplick. And I was James Bong.
James Bong, yeah. And I highly recommend it.
That captured what I tried to imbue in the 90s.
Yeah, so imbue and also inhale, I suspect.
That's the whole point.
One of the things about the alternative media that is kind of interesting, and you know, now it's the alternative media, it is the media now,
yeah.
because as you were saying, things have fractured
There's
and
so
fragmented
many.
in I think ultimately good ways. What are some of the essential characteristics of that? You seem to be more engaged, not just with the people that you're interviewing, but on your Twitter feed, for instance. You don't just trash talk big name people, but you engage individuals, you know, who may have a couple dozen followers.
I try not to punch down, but I do engage with people.
Yeah.
I probably do less of it now than I did before because I don't want to punch down. And like sometimes even just responding to somebody brings them attention, negative attention,
sure,
that maybe isn't fair even if they're starting out being rude. I think that one of the things, my first editor for my first full-time job in journalism was David Carr, mm-hmm, the late legendary media writer for the New York Times. He went on to become.
Who started at the City Paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he started at Minnesota City Pages.
Right. I'm sorry, but he was the editor of the City Paper.
And one of the things that I was a crime and police reporter for City Paper, and he was always on my case for not being sufficiently skeptical of police. He thought I was too pro-police. He never came out and said it, but I knew that he thought that. And that was good, that back and forth that I had with him. And while I think it's important to support police when they need help and they're doing the right thing, I also, because of David Carr, recognize that there are times that the police need to be questioned. And that's an important part of my job. Same thing with decision makers in the military, less so individual soldiers on the ground. But I think being willing to challenge American institutions while also being respectful of the people, mm-hmm, who are, you know, the beat cop or the
military troop. I mean, you've written a book about soldiers in overseas, and it's it's easy to make a distinction really between the people who call the shots and the people who follow the orders, but also holding the people who follow the orders accountable when they do horrible things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, of course, I mean, if they do horrible things, that's a war crime. But I mean, theoretically, but it's important. I mean, I think there's too much reverence for the people who make the decisions, mm-hmm, and maybe not enough respect for the people who are actually carrying out the orders. And that I think that mindset is one that comes from the alternative media.
What about the distinction, or maybe the distinction isn't the right word, but maybe the distance between kind of the expert and the audience? So, you know, people go back, and we both know the work of Joseph W. Campbell,
we love
great
him, right?
Media critic.
But
he always talks about, you know, when people say, oh, Cronkite was the most trusted man in America, it turns out that the only person who really believed that was Walter Cronkite, who kind of made it up. And that, you know, there's no evidence that LBJ ever saw Walter Cronkite, you know, say we've lost Vietnam and that's why he decided not to run or anything. But, you know, in the golden age or the golden narrative, there's Walter Cronkite and he is up on Olympus just delivering the news. The audience is down here. There doesn't need to be any interaction. It seems the alternative media or social media, or the internet, the decentralization of knowledge and power and information that happened in the 90s and continues, it's a lot about, you know, you are not as far away from your audience as, you know, even Wolf Blitzer was 10 years ago, or Bernard Shaw, or the early, you know, lions of CNN. Is that true?
Yeah. And there's, look, the old model, the Huntley and Brinkley and the Walter Cronkite and the John Chancellor, that's gone. There aren't three networks anymore. And there are dozens. There's no one person who commands the kind of power and respect, mm-hmm, that Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow and the others once did, just because there are so many different outlets and so many different people, and the audiences are so much smaller. Mm-hmm. I think it is important I don't have a problem with that. Who cares if I have a problem with it? So it is important for us to try to be transparent as much as possible. Mm-hmm. For us to explain decisions, for us to do interviews with people who challenge the media. I read all the media criticism, whether it's from Media Matters, mm-hmm, or from Newsbusters. Some of it I agree with, some of it I disagree with, but I read it all. I read Reason all the time. And look, that is, we're just in a different world. And just one thing, just a quick advertisement for the book, because you bring up W. Joseph Campbell,
right,
who, as you and I talked about just a minute ago, is the ultimate buzzkill, the mm-hmm. ultimate party pooper. You want to talk about some great American
myth. He did a great thing about how Orson Welles' radio broadcast War of the Worlds, like, nobody gave a shit. You know, that's all. Orson Welles created a great myth around
that
it.
That people right? were, yeah. like, freaking out and jumping off of bridges.
Like shooting, you know, as monsters are due on Maple Street and they're shooting each other. No, it didn't happen.
So I read him all the time. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a... it's a hate read because yeah. you're like, oh, you're going to blow up another myth right. that I love.
Well, this is what about Joe Kennedy. You know, Joe Kennedy Sr. wasn't a bootlegger and he wasn't really a Nazi. These are things that I know because
he was an appeaser though.
Yeah, he was worried. You know, he didn't
he
think America
appeaser.
Could win. Yeah, no.
He was on the wrong side.
I agree. And all I'm saying is like, we have to give up our cherished dreams even, you know, that are too good to cherish.
So he just to give him credit, there's a scene in the book where Joe McCarthy, as you mentioned, yeah. looms large in the book. He's a character in the book. Charlie interacts with him, et cetera. And there's a scene in the book where Charlie goes back to his parents' house. And his dad's there, Winston, and he's watching Murrow eviscerate McCarthy, just destroy him. Yeah. And they have a conversation about McCarthy, but one of the things that occurs to Charlie is, you know, Edward R. Murrow, where you been?
Yeah.
You know, this is spring 1954. Senator Margaret Chase Smith took on McCarthy 4 years before, and other journalists have been taking on McCarthy for years, whether Jack Anderson or others.
Drew Pearson,
even who I think got into a physical fight with McCarthy, and or it wasn't so much of a fight. McCarthy punched him and he fell. And even mentions how the cartoonist Walt Kelly, who did Pogo, had even taken on McCarthy a year before. So as much as I personally revere Edward R. Murrow, I learned from Campbell that Murrow was a little late to the party, and I had Charlie reflect that.
So
in the book.
Two quick final questions. First, you know, you mentioned David Brinkley, and I grew up watching news in the 80s, and This Week with David Brinkley was a highlight because Brinkley was funny and wry and everything.
And he hated bullshit. He hated it.
But then I learned that he was actually personal friends with a ton of the people that he covered, and they would all go vacationing together
really?
In North Carolina. And I felt let down by that.
That is disappointing,
yeah. And
really?
So will you, along with, you know, posting, you know, how much money you made at a speech and where it went to, when you vacation with Cocaine Mitch, or you go out to Harry Reid.
We're going to Bogota this spring.
So you will publish that too, though.
I go on vacation with my brother and his family and with family friends. But, you know, I promise that if I ever go on vacation with a politician, I will disclose it on my Tumblr account. But, I mean, I don't think they want to go on vacation with me, I'll tell you. When Barack Obama left the White House, he didn't keep in touch.
Yeah.
He didn't keep in touch. But, yes, I mean, it is disappointing. I think Ben Bradley has, in retrospect, talked about how he was too close to President Kennedy, right?
Clearly, So it's an interesting thing, and this is what I think part of, in this broad sense, this alternative media world, is that there is a forced transparency. It's forced on you, so you might as well get ahead of it in a way. And I think that'll help politicians, the media.
But we need to be ethical, also.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's,
you know, for instance, I am a huge Eagles fan, as I've already mentioned. An Arab country that shall not be named invited me to fly to the game on their private jet, attend the Super Bowl, and fly back so I wouldn't have to spend a night in Minnesota, which, by the way, is a lovely state. I had no problem with it. I mean, like, I talked to my wife about it because, of course, I was never going to accept this, but the fact that they were offering it, this Arab country, meant that there were people accepting it, and it was just crazy to me.
I'm sure they gave the seat to Charlie Rose or somebody, right? Or maybe Mika Brzezinski.
Charlie Rose has time on his hands, I think it's fair to say.
Well, at least it's only time on his hands these days, right? Final question, and in a very minor but very real way, you owe your journalism to Jacob Solem, a longtime Reason senior editor.
Absolutely. Jacob Solem.
Explain.
Jacob Solem, and I've said this on Twitter before. Yeah. Jake, we went to the same small Jewish day school, 6 through 12, in the suburbs of Philadelphia. I was in 7th grade. It was a small school. So as a 7th grader, I was able to be the... As an 8th grader, I was able to be the art editor of the school newspaper because nobody 9, 10, 11, 12 wanted the job because they were much cooler than I was, I suppose. So I was the art editor, and Jacob Sullum was one of the editors, and he had recruited me, first of all, to do cartoons for the Akibagram, which was just what it was called. I think it's now it's called the Cougar Chronicle. And then he encouraged me to try to be editor the next year. So the next year, when the Akibagram had its first meeting, and I was the only one who showed up, except I brought my friends from ninth grade then, we took over the paper. Because you know, when you have a school of 300 people, and each class is like 50, you know, it's very possible that other grades just won't even know or care. So yeah, so he got me involved. I became editor-in-chief of the school paper in ninth grade. You know, so kudos to Jacob Sullum, who I still read all the time. And looking back on, if you imagine what he was like in high school, that's exactly what he was like in high school. He wore a tie to school. He had a briefcase. Jacob Sullum had a brief, this is, at least in my memory, he had a briefcase.
He's unbuttoned a couple buttons. And,
is that right?
Yeah, I think, and he's more laid back now, after 20 years of telecommuting from his house.
The only legalization of marijuana advocate who has never smoked marijuana, perhaps.
Oh, trust me, I think he's crossed that line.
Oh, has he?
He had to go undercover to really get to the story.
Oh, good for
and
him.
And he may well have gotten too close.
For journalism, at least, for journalism.
Yes, no,
but the thing that he...
He's kind of like to marijuana what Al Pacino was to rough trade in Cruising.
Maybe went a little too deep.
That's right.
A little too Stanislavski.
Yeah.
So a little method acting there. I will just say this also. He should know that, you know, I think it's important to know what you were like as a kid. And when he was in 11th grade, 12th grade, and I was in 7th grade, 8th grade, he was nice. He was nice. And you don't have to be nice to a 7th grader when you're in 12th grade. But he was. So that says something good about him, I think.
Certainly. Well, we'll leave it there. We have been talking with Jake Tapper of CNN and the author of the new best-selling novel, The Hellfire Club. Jake, thanks for talking.
Thank you so much, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.